We're going to be looking at the text of Micah chapter 6 and verse 8. It's a really popular passage, and it finds itself in modern culture because very often we apply it to a perception limited to public policy or politics, when that's not exactly obviously the context of this verse and where this is really driving to. It's actually part of a similar theme that takes place in the scriptures, where there is a reduction of the big pictures of the Bible into very simple statements. Jesus does it. We'll talk about one of those a little bit later. And Micah does it here. Because think about this. When we get into the text here, in Micah 6, verse 8, it reads, "He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?" Now, if you think about that, is that all that there really is? Is that all that God required of the people of Israel, or even requires of us? Just those two or three things? You may have noticed that in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, those books by themselves are significantly dense with information, containing perhaps as much as 600 specific instructions or regulations. And underneath of that, God requires justice, kindness, or sometimes translated mercy or faithfulness, and humility before God. Well, Micah is the one who tells us this. But remember, in Micah 6, verse 8, in the beginning part of that, it's not Micah telling us. It is God who shows us. And Micah then, in essence, reminds us of this biblical truth. And so I think it's important as we remind ourselves of that common thread that we've used to introduce each of these lessons, the hallmark principle. And you're probably tired of hallmark stories, so you're not going to get any more for the rest of the week by intention. But I hope by now you're trained to look for them. That in some way, the way you see the Bible is including that concept now where whenever it happens, you're going to think about it and you're going to not be able to forget it. And it's going to tie the scriptures together in a healthier way. And rather than having a skeleton with no meat, the entire animal of the Bible is there for us to see, enjoy, and rejoice about. But I'll tell you this, the God who gave Israel 600 instructions is happy to condense them at times into three for us to understand. And it's nothing new, because in Matthew 23 and verse 23, the Bible reads this way, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others." And so I think you can probably quickly recognize that what is cited for us in Matthew 23:23 really comes off the echoing of Micah chapter 6 and verse 8. These are sympathetic passages. If you want to have the academic term that is applied to this concept that I've been calling the hallmark principle, it's a term called the intertextuality of the Bible. That's a really heavy, weighty term. If you want to make it more simple and maybe easier to remember, you're reading the Bible beside the Bible. It's like the two rails of the train tracks, and they're both going to the same destination. And they're both aligned on the same ideas. So what Micah has God's insight for us in Micah 6, verse 8, is repeated to us in Matthew 23, verse 23. And all of these things sum up to tell us basic principles about God's will. Then we have other instances of this same thing taking place. And they all kind of lean towards a common destination. Here's this other one. This one comes from Deuteronomy in chapter 10 and verses 12 and 13. There it reads this way. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." Excuse me. That's Matthew 23. I need Deuteronomy 10 open for me to be able to read it. "And now, Israel, what does the Lord require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord, which I am commanding today for your good. Fear, walk, love, serve, obey. So in Deuteronomy, what Micah gives us is three. The Deuteronomic text gives us is five. Now, Jesus, obviously the master teacher, is able to engage in the ultimate reduction, condensing the entirety of the law and the prophets, virtually the whole of the Old Testament, to two fundamental commands, which he calls the first and second greatest of all, back in Matthew 22. There in the text, particularly in verses 34 through 40, it reads in this way. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? And he said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. And that comes in part by pulling things from two different sections of the scriptures. One pulls from Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, love the Lord your God. The other one pulls from Leviticus 19 and verse 18, to love your neighbor as yourself. But those two pillars create the foundation for the entirety, the encompassing aspects of every component of the Old Testament. I think it's important for us to then have that in our mind as we begin to dig through these greater sections of the scriptures. And so when we think again of this passage of Micah chapter 6 and verse 8, which reads, he has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God, we're beginning to have perhaps the opportunity to gather a better perspective of what the prophets do in their role and how we understand them maybe a little bit better. I'll suggest that in part also that these powerful and concise summaries remind us that being in a right relationship with God is never simply a matter of crossing all the dots off the page, of making your checklist and making sure all 600 things are taken care of. You see, what it is a matter of fundamental commitment to God himself as God. And it is very often expressed through love and humble submission to God. We might define that as our vertical relationship, acting with justice and compassion in our human affairs. And we might consider that as our horizontal or side-by-side relationship. And with that in mind, I think it's important for us to pause and reflect and think about the prophets, because they're one of our signposts to help gather this grand information as to whom Israel is. And I think to do so, we're going to probably look at about five concepts tonight that will help us rethink the role of the prophet. Now, maybe you're like me, and the very first time you connected the concept of prophet, you brought with it all of the baggage that you thought a prophet would be like. I think for me in particular, very often a prophet is someone who tells you what's going to happen and only what's going to happen. Because we think about prophecy and prophetic work very often as future or fortune telling outside of the biblical narratives. But in the context of the biblical narratives, that's not the limited use of the term. Further, for the prophets, we're covering 15 named books. There's one individual who would also be included as a prophet that we're not going to really spend much time on tonight, but who also is a prophet of the Old Testament, and that's John. John, who harbingers the birth of Christ, who harbingers the work of Christ. There's no named book for him, and so he's not fitting into our category in that way, and he actually scoots forward in the narrative quite a bit. But throughout the entire Old Testament, there's a number of individuals who serve in this role that have already been on the scene for us. We've seen Moses. Don't forget that his sister Miriam is identified as one as well in Exodus chapter 15 and verse 20. Obviously, the text of Micah ties that together in a very specific way in Micah 6 and verse 4, which precedes this verse 8 text we're using as our signpost. In some ways, by the way, I will tell you, there are two great things that are easy to catch about Moses. One, Moses really is the model for all the latter prophets. Secondly, if you're thinking about the concept of academic endeavors, Moses is probably the most plagiarized prophet of the Bible. He gets quoted the most without being given his citation and attribution. And so Moses finds out being used that way, because in many senses, it's not Moses who is speaking. He is speaking for God. And that's the real key concept. Remember, when we think about a prophet, their fundamental role isn't future telling. It's forth telling, telling something that God needs said. In Deuteronomy 18 and verse 18, it reads, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I commanded him. There are prophets like Samuel and Nathan, Elijah and Elisha, and many others who are mentioned in the history sections of the Bible books who aren't even given a name. They're just a prophet. Some of the most notable prophets, by the way, are women, Miriam and Deborah. And then we have, again, these 15 books of the Old Testament, which are the collections of messages particular to named prophets. In the way in which the Old Testament is bound together prior to the New Testament text, if we're talking about the period that is sometimes called Second Temple Jerusalem, that's all the time right before and right after Jesus, they were bound together in two segments. There's the three large prophets because of the scope of their writing. That's Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And then the 12. And I've taken as a habit of mine, I try not to refer to the 12 as the minor prophets, because I think there's an unintended consequence of talking about the brevity of their texts that we think their message is also brief in value. But if I tell myself it's the 12, not only does it sound cooler, which quite frankly is one of the reasons why I'll refer to the 12 now, but also I think it allows them to have the space that God gave them. It allows them to exist in the role that they needed to be, not in conflict with the so-called major prophets, but you have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 for convenience. And I try very often to make sure that they get their names as well when we get narrowed down in the text, and we will. Prophets then are men and women who speak out for God. In essence, this is what the Lord says. And so with that in mind, I think it's important to pay attention to the kind of message that they give. It's really valuable to get our hands on it a little bit. The language the prophets use is very different than the dry nature of a history book. It's not essentially the same as, say, Nostradamus, who is a faulty future teller that you may have read about at some point, because the language that the prophets use is very similar to the language of the preacher, the language of the street communicator. And by the street communicator, I'm talking about things that go across cultures, spoken word poetry, pop music that brings in rap tonality, that's a conversational style rather than a lyrical style, but also even sometimes we find some of those lyrical stylings in their messages themselves. And I'm not going to delve very deeply into the language, because that's a very complicated and labor-intensive study, but I want you to think about something when you're reading the prophets. It's very, very difficult to take these original languages, bring them into our language, and retain the rhyme and meter of that message. But very often, they had a pacing, or we might say historically, a sing-song feel to it by the way that they would explain things. Because all of these messages that we are reading were actually originally spoken, for the most part, to be heard, and not just written to be read. And it didn't mean necessarily that the prophet would be the one saying it. If you remember, and you were with us a couple nights ago, I showed the interior space of a synagogue that would have been contemporary to Paul, contemporary to the disciples, and contemporary to Jesus. The scrolls would have been brought out and set upon that stone table, which would have been the equivalent of their lectern. No podium there because that angled side's going up. So the lectern and speaking space was down low. And someone would read the scriptures out loud so that everyone could hear them. So with a message that's designed to be heard, it's prepared and spoken differently. Some of you maybe in your lives have actually participated in live productions where you've read from a script. You may notice that script writing is very different than book writing. And book writing is very different than academic writing. They're entirely different processes, and they're actually placed on the page in very different ways. That's designed to accommodate the idea that this message will be spoken maybe in concert with others or with emotion to explain and to educate and instruct. Because these messages at first are also something that should be, and you'll notice this in all of the prophets, they are motivated to persuade. They're trying to draw people in with what they are saying and get them to act equivalent to the message. And sometimes they need to shock people into paying attention. And I will tell you this, in the Old Testament particularly, although also in the New Testament, we struggle a little bit living in the time frame that we live. We are post-Puritan America. And the Bibles that we read from are heavily whitewashed. And not just with some of the conversations about the death of a human body. A lot of the things that are discussed in the prophets' works are strikingly uncomfortable to the ear because of the nature of what God needed the prophets to say. And if you do a detailed textual study at times, you'll see some of those things highlight themselves out. But you'll recognize that sometimes they are speaking about things that are very uncomfortable. Isaiah does this, Elijah does this, Jeremiah does this, most of the major prophets do this, Hosea does this. They talk about uncomfortable things to draw people back to God. The second thing that's true, and I mentioned this already, in the writing of the prophets, is that they are very often working through Hebrew poetic forms. You may have heard of the concept of a chiasm before. That's a technical term that describes the structure of Hebrew poetry. There's also, in other cultures, you've got poetry forms that are more familiar to them. Some people love haikus. That's a type of poetry that works on syllabic forms and tries to condense ideas into rigid structure. English poetry, American poetry is most typified by the modern pop genres. And so if you're listening to Kanye West, if you're listening to Grand Funk Railroad, if you're listening to Pearl Jam, that's the poetry that we're familiar with. We're familiar with that rhyme and meter. Well, Hebrew has that as well. And very often it's a chiastic form. And you're like, well, you say chiasm. What does that mean? Well, go down to Subway and buy a sandwich. You've now picked up a dietary chiasm. You say, what is that? Well, you've got your bread on the top and the bottom, your meat in the middle, and then the things that get you from the bread to the meat and then back to the bread again. And there are repeats in that fluffy taco of a Subway sandwich because they only cut half of it down and they treat it like a taco. That's what a chiasm is. Things on the top are the same as the things on the bottom, and they're often all wrapped together in the same theme. A chiasm like that occurs sometimes across an entire book. Many of Moses' speeches are laid out with deep chiastic forms. A lot of the Psalms do this. But I want you to open your Bibles to the text of Jeremiah in chapter 2. Because beyond the poetry and beyond the blocks of prose, the writers and speakers in the poetic role and in the prophetic role of God use their words to paint pictures for us. If you remember, a particular PBS master painter would tell us that when he made mistakes, all you had to do was paint some happy clouds up in the corner. Bob Ross was really good to teach us that simple premise. But Jeremiah uses the same idea. So if you're in Jeremiah chapter 2, I'll tell you, I'm not going to bring in all of them, but he uses at least a dozen word pictures. And the prophets love word pictures just as much as Jesus loves parables. So in that text, very quickly, in Jeremiah 2, verse 2, can you see his picture of a bride? Jeremiah 2, verse 3, the first fruits. Jeremiah 2, verse 13, a spring and a cistern. Jeremiah 2, 15, lions. Jeremiah 2, 21, a vine. Jeremiah 2, 22, soap. And Jeremiah 2, 23 and 24, camels and donkeys. Now, I'll tell you, all those pictures have the potential to fire off the electrons in your brain, and the neurons are, and the synapses are going nuts, and you're probably thinking about where those all occur in the New Testament right now. These are more Hallmark opportunities for you. You probably note in Jeremiah 2, as well as in Ezekiel and in Isaiah, how Jesus pulls off some of these same vine pictures in his speeches about the vine. These pictures then are also sometimes seen in what we might describe as words that then move or show us what God wants to be part of our understanding. And actually themselves will often serve as illustration too. Isaiah in chapter 20 shows us that Isaiah goes around naked in Jerusalem to portray the shame of captivity that lies ahead. Jeremiah in Jeremiah 13 buys and wears a new linen sash, then buries it until it is rotten and useless to show what Israel has become. Jeremiah also puts on an ox yoke on his shoulders and bursts into an international diplomatic conference in Jerusalem to tell the ambassadors of other nations to submit to the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar, because God has raised him up for that moment. And Ezekiel lies on his side, besieging a model of Jerusalem on a large clay brick to show that the first exiles of that city will soon be captured and destroyed in Ezekiel 4 and 5. So I'll suggest to you then that that tells us a little bit more, especially if we keep those principles in mind, the next time we read through the prophets. We start looking for the times when they show us. We start digging around for the times that they're going to sing to us and speak to us in prose, and we listen to be persuaded. But who actually are they? I'm only going to cover a few of them. Obviously, we're not going to cover every prophet from Genesis all the way to the arrival of John, but we are going to get through quite a few of them. And we're going to do it using a more modern concept, which is we're going to make a little timeline, but this is a super simple one. It's just going to have three significant dates on it. The first one are the 9th century prophets. 9th century prophets are coming primarily after our We Three Kings moment. If you want to think about it another way, it's kind of preceding the into captivity three dips down and the return from captivity three dips up on the bigger timeline. You may have noticed that it takes three steps for all of Israel to go into captivity and three steps for all of Israel to come back. So these 9th century prophets tend to be before any of that takes place. So with Elijah and Elisha, these are prophets that are in the northern kingdom of Israel before Christ, around that 9th century time frame. Elijah's name sums up his life's work. It means, in a very practical sense, Yahweh is God. And his mission is very singular, to bring the worship of Israel back into Yahweh's heart, and then they into and have Yahweh back in theirs. He wants them to understand that Yahweh is the true and living God, in conflict and contrast to Baal or Baal, the Canaanite god, whom Queen Jezebel, the Phoenician wife of King Ahab, is promoting. And so very often you see him engaging in direct conflict. Even the events on Mount Carmel are indicative of that conflict. And then you have Elisha, and that term there plays off of Elijah, but this word, which is his name, means God saves. He is trained as Elijah's assistant and then takes over for him as God's prophet, leading a small band of unnamed prophets in a ministry that stretches almost half of a century and over the reigns of several kings in the north. God works many miracles through him, and he serves as the vessel of forth-telling for God. But then we move into the 8th century prophets. The 8th century prophets are the ones who are preceding the breaking of the nation into its captivity. Some of the truly great prophets of Israel live in this time frame. We're going to select a couple of them to get deeper looks into, Amos and Hosea from the north, and Isaiah and Micah from the south. And these individuals are sent to these two kingdoms to again serve in that basic role. Amos is actually from Judah in the south, but God takes him and tells him to go preach in the north. It's a very Pauline moment for him, where someone who would have seemed to be more comfortable in one realm is sent to the entire opposite of his comfort zone to serve as God's messenger. And Hosea lived about the same time as Amos, maybe a little bit later, and his ministry was mostly directed to the northern kingdom. God's message to him comes by way of bitter experience. God tells him to marry a prostitute named Gomer. She's unfaithful, bears children that are not his own, and that becomes a picture of redemption, because her unfaithfulness is redeemed by the prophet, just as Israel's unfaithfulness will be redeemed by God. And there's a powerful, powerful story through all of that. And then we have Isaiah. Isaiah is like a prince among the prophets. The book in his name is one of the massive mountain peaks of the Bible. 66 chapters. In some ways, it mimics the entirety of the Bible. It's very likely that he came from a noble family, since he seems to have easy access to the royal court and to the reigns of several kings of Judah in the second half of the 8th century. His role seems to shift from respected advisor to a very, very fierce critic. And finally, we have Micah. We'll get back to Isaiah's message on another night. He's actually the core message for our gospel sermon. Micah is another prophet that was in Judah about the same time as Isaiah, and they may well have known each other. They have the same passion for justice, the same strong condemnation for those who are greedily exploiting the poor, and the same vision of God's future reign among all the nations. It was Micah who gives us that sentence we're using as a signpost for this lesson. And then our last group, 7th century. So we've got 9th century, 8th century, 7th century. At this point in time, the Assyrian Empire has dominated the ancient Near East for about 150 years. But towards the end of the 7th century BC, the Assyrian Empire had collapsed and was replaced by Babylon. And the Babylon captivity is about to become full swing. This also includes a portion of the reign of King Josiah. And in this time frame, we have prophets like Jeremiah. Jeremiah exists in the whirlpool of religious, social, and political confusion. And God sends Jeremiah to us. Jeremiah grew up in a family of priests just a few miles from Jerusalem. He seems to know the scriptures from his youth, and his faith in life should characterize God's covenant with the people. But what he sees from his visits to Jerusalem is the life of a people, top to bottom, who are in complete denial of whom they are. And he weeps. That's why we often refer to him as the weeping prophet. His sorrow, his pain, becomes our pain, for it is Israel's pain. And after the death of King Josiah, whom Jeremiah in the text admires and praises, Jeremiah is hated by the kings who follow, especially King Jehoiakim, who burns a full scroll of 23 years worth of Jeremiah's preaching. Can you pause for a minute and just think what it would be like to lose 23 years worth of Bible work for those who preach and teach, and not to do so because of an accident, but because someone who was the intended audience despised it so much they destroyed it all? That takes place in Jeremiah's life. Out of the suffering, he pours out his feelings, and in essence, God's feelings come back to us in the same vein of frustration, protest, and depression. And those are all preserved for us in his work. We probably owe his book to the scribe Baruch, who produced the scrolls of Jeremiah's preaching, including the one that got burned, which he rewrote from scratch. That brings us also to a few others that exist. Jeremiah is that major prophet in the 7th century of Judah, but two other prophets of that era, Habakkuk and Zephaniah. Now, those are some of the examples of these individuals. There's a few more, obviously, in the literary prophets. There's a number of them who are not named for us. But we need to think more about their actual message. And their message can be broken down into three concepts. They are pulling from the entirety of biblical history, from Solomon to the exile, the full rogues gallery of kings, prophets, all of them who have much to teach us, and they give us their reflections. And here are probably three things we can identify very quickly. Number one, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is in sovereign control of world history. It's repeated to us, by the way, in the entering refrains of the text of Revelation in chapter 1. There it says, and from Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead, and the ruler of kings on earth, to him who loves us and has freed us from our sins by his blood. The prophets have asserted in the Old Testament that Yahweh is God, not merely of Israel, but of all kings and of all nations. And they continue to reaffirm that in their wider message. Secondly, and this is what is identified specifically in Micah, also in Deuteronomy, and repeated by Jesus, that God demands justice. And I think it's important for us to recognize that as much as, and I've said this about myself, I am not a political person. Politics do matter to God, but not necessarily in the ways that we think about them. We think about politics, and very often we're distressed because it's about two guys arguing constantly about two things. And pick your election, that's usually narrowed down to about two subjects. The politics that matter to God are incumbent to the things that matter to God: justice, mercy, and humility. Those things are the political concepts that matter. And real justice is more than just judgment or punishment. Biblical justice is more often seen in the prophets like this: if you have power, you are obligated to use it to pull others up next to you. That's the general tenor of the message of justice in the prophets. Thirdly, in these messages, we see and recognize that outward religion without ethical transformation is an abomination to God. Jesus even talks about it in the New Testament in one of the most striking condemnations. He looks to the crowd of people who should be the moral compass, and he says to them, "You are whitewashed tombs. You are clean on the outside, but on the inside you are full of dead men's bones." That's a reduction or a condensed version of all the prophets' condemnations towards the majority of the history of Israel. And it's important for us to pause and reflect and ask a deep question of ourselves. In my life, before or right now, or what I plan for my future, have I had a phase where that was me? Or am I in that phase right now? The message of the prophets is a great message to persuade us to change, just like the message of Jesus is a great message to persuade us to change. So if you're struggling with what to do with figure out those issues of justice and politics, spend your time in the prophets. Probably better served doing that than spending your time listening to the politicians who clearly just want to get reelected. You're going to get a greater value in understanding those things from that time. And that message of ethical transformation, of transforming who we are, is very often simplified into the fact that we need to be more like God in our thinking, in our behavior, in our kindness. I've pointed out before, and I'll use this as a simple illustration, that in the story of Ruth, you find probably my favorite positive Old Testament story. And Ruth is a really amazing person. I'm going to use it to illustrate for us this ethical transformation that's necessary. Ruth came from the people of Moab. And it's important to understand how awful that was for an Israelite in that time frame. To the Israelite, a Moab was a seductress. They were the loose women who would use their bodies to persuade people. Now, the Moabitess Ruth comes into Israel, and she is transformed because she does not come into that area and actually do any of those things, even though her mother-in-law tries to convince her to do that. What she does is work hard in the fields. And then what about Boaz? Boaz, who is convinced towards justice and mercy, sees the character that she has. And you'll note that when she goes back home the next day, even though she's already gleaned a significant amount, he blesses her with extra. He gives her enough sustenance that from one harvest season of gleaning, her and her mother-in-law would have enough food for a year. That's justice in the biblical construct. He has now used his power to lift up those who are weak around him. And that helps us better understand what kind of person Boaz was and how awesome he is as a counterpart to Ruth in those powerful stories we see in the scriptures. And then we have a text like Amos. And I want to bring Amos in here to understand this wider message section. Amos chapter 5 and verse 21 reads this way. I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fattened animals, I will not look upon them. Take away from me the noise of your songs. To the melody of your harps, I will not listen. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. God cannot and will not be worshipped apart from a commitment to righteousness and justice, faithfulness and love. These are the things that define God's own character down to the very core of his being and are his delight. And the message of the prophets, this wider message of all of them together, very often was designed to drive Israel back to those core principles. And I'll suggest to you, for you and I, as we're thinking about their messages, we should be driven to those same truths as well, to those same biblical structures that change the way we see those who are next to us, who might be above us and below us, and serve them in the ways that God serves us. So returning to that opening sentence from Micah, we recognize in the broader sense of the text that God has no need for all of our invented lavish rituals. What he really wants, again, is justice, compassion, and humility. And by the way, if you remember from the text of Matthew that we've already read for, it's very often obvious that Jesus agrees, because he echoes it. He treats it in that intertextual way, and it's a hallmark of the Bible story. So back to the covenant. If you remember, one of the things we emphasized with David, one of the things we emphasized with each of these steps along the journey, is that there's a covenant that undergirds these truths. You see, God sends his prophets primarily to remind Israel of their relationship, their covenant relationship that exists between them and God, and to point out the consequences, the ramifications. They're calling out, reinforcing, explaining, exhorting, and applying what the people should already know on the basis of what God has already done and said. In simple terms, the covenant between Yahweh God and Israel always involves three things. By the way, if you're building your sermons and you're looking for a structure, here's a three-point sermon waiting to happen over and over again. Number one, there is a history. Something happened. As an example, God acted to redeem Israel by delivering them out of slavery in Egypt, or the wandering, or any of the other times that God came to rescue them. God has done so much for them out of his love and grace, and that's the foundation of the law and prophets. That's always point one in the message of the prophets. And if you pay attention to the preaching of the apostles in the book of Acts and the teaching of Jesus, it very much follows that same flow. Then there's a commitment. In the covenant in particular, God had committed himself to be Yahweh's God, to be Israel's God, to bless and protect them, and to make them his instrument for bringing blessing to all the nations. And so you had history that led to the commitment that existed between God and Israel. That's your second point in all the message of the prophets. And then finally, there are always sanctions. In the prophets' work, when they're forth telling for him, that comes as the natural next step. If Israel will live in God's ways and obey his law, they will continue to enjoy God's blessing. But if they don't, just simply continuing as things are, then God's grace will come into play, which always has to follow his judgment. Those are things that are intertwined in the messages of the prophet. So you can see in their messages, laying out a light outline, a history, a commitment, and a sanction. It's the same structure in all the statements of the prophets. And so in their messages, they will remind Israel of their history. They will remind Israel of their commitments. And they will remind Israel of God's threats and promises. That always goes back to the core of the covenant for them. And it's super simple, but often they are painting with the palette of all the possibilities. Literary action, physical interaction, reminder about what God has said, sometimes the demonstrations of the power of God. I want us to also understand this. The prophets also have an ability that's important for us to develop. They can see beyond the disaster. They can see beyond the immediate calamity and are reminded at the end of that message that they leave the seed for hope. They know that judgment will not be God's final word. They know that when Jerusalem is destroyed, that's not the end of God's people. And God's promise to Abraham still stands, and God will be faithful to that promise, since the salvation of the world depends on it. So the prophets then bring a message of hope that rides above the sorrowness of every aspect of their condemnation, even in the face of disaster. They have good news to share, and there really is gospel in the Old Testament. And should the Lord will, we're going to have a chance to look at it over the next couple nights of the closing parts of this series of studies. And I'm really hoping that as we do that, seeing both the text from Isaiah and the text from the book of Psalms will brighten our understanding of the Old Testament, and maybe for each of us, give us hope when we really need hope. And I think days like the last 8 months have been plentiful with opportunities for a need for hope.